Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our IQ window forecast going down to 30 degrees tonight and clear. It's just you and me. This is where the past meets the future, and here the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Tonight we have Stephanie Paulus coming on the program in about an hour. She's one of the organizers of the Breakthrough Energy Movement, which has had their debut event in Holland last month. They're going to have another one in Boulder, Colorado in October of this year. She's also got a long history in auto racing, one of the support people, and has stories to tell. We're going to explore all kinds of new energy ideas and maybe some of the obstacles keeping that stuff coming to fruition. 1 hour from now, solar wind is a brisk 435 kilometers per second, and there are four tiny, worthless sunspots on the sun today. For the seventh day in a row, solar activity is very, very low. None of the sunspots on the Earth side of the sun is actively flaring. The NOAA forecasters put the odds of an M-class solar flare today at no more than 5%. You would think this is good news, but it may not be. Without some kind of solar activity, the atmosphere of Earth actually becomes slightly smaller and more vulnerable to galactic effects. We'll keep you posted. Those of you that pay attention to some of the activities, cyber activities that are going on out there in the world, will know that we have a cyber battle going on out there between a group called Anonymous and those that run the government side of the internet communications. Anonymous has announced Operation Last Resort that is beginning today, Sunday. The quote from them is, 2 weeks ago today, a line was crossed. 2 weeks ago today, Aaron Schwartz was killed. Killed because he faced an impossible choice. Killed because he was forced into playing a game he could not win. A twisted and distorted perversion of justice. A game where the only winning move was not to play. Aaron Schwartz was the internet prodigy who helped create RSS when he was only 14 years old. Quite an accomplishment. He went on to help develop social networking like Reddit. 2 weeks ago, the 26-year-old Schwartz hanged himself. Although he suffered from bouts of depression, friends and family say Schwartz killed himself because federal prosecutors were hounding him and threatening him with psychological torture and life in prison. Anonymous is incredibly good at what it does, and many believe their skills will make them invulnerable to capture and detection. However, one former FBI officer who spoke on the condition of anonymity noted, "It just takes one person to tell us everything. That is how we will get them. Either they will make a mistake because of their huge egos, or someone will talk. But watch, we will get them." In the meantime, Anonymous appears set to continue their operation. The end of their statement warns, this time there will be change or there will be chaos. Their considerable computer skills certainly suggest they have the power to bring that chaos. Control-Alt-Delete, Aaron. Also in the news, there are some new job openings coming. I know. A lot of you are underemployed or looking for something really exciting. This might be it for you. A new asteroid mining company launched Tuesday of this last week with the goal of helping humanity expand across the solar system by tapping the vast riches of space rocks. The new firm called Deep Space Industries, Inc. Now, wouldn't that be a cool business card? Do you have a business card? Yes, I do. Oh, you work for Deep Space Industries, Inc. Anyway, they announced today, actually this week, that it plans to launch a fleet of prospecting spacecraft in 2015. That means they need your help now. Then begin harvesting metals and water from near-Earth asteroids within a decade or so. Such work could make it possible to build and refuel spacecraft far above our planet's surface, thus helping our species get a foothold in the final frontier. Using resources harvested in space is the only way to afford permanent space development, Deep Space CEO David Gump, not related to Forrest, said in a statement. Deep Space Industries will hold a press conference today in Santa Monica, California at 10 a.m. To unveil more details of its bold mission plan. You can watch the webcast live. You can go to space.com and keep up with them, or just listen to X-Squared Radio. We'll keep you up to date with what's going on. I don't know if you realize this, but I was interviewed once when I was in the eighth grade for a newspaper article. I told you this once before. If you listened to this program often enough, you would remember. And they asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I said I wanted to be an asteroid miner. So this is kind of near and dear to my heart, and of course out of my age range now. But it's perfect for you. More than 900 new asteroids that pass near Earth are discovered every year, Gump explained. They can be like Iron Range of Minnesota was for the Detroit car industry last century, a key resource located near where it was needed. In this case, metals and fuel from asteroids can expand the in-space industries of this century. That's our strategy. Maybe you're looking for a good investment. You might want to check out Deep Space Industries, Inc. Deep Space is the second company to jump into the asteroid mining business. Competition is always good. The first is the billionaire-backed firm Planetary Resources, and it had its own unveiling last April. I just have visions of Salvage One. You remember Andy Griffith, the show Salvage One? Great show. Fantastic junkyard business. Deep Space will inspect potential mining targets with 55-pound spacecraft it calls Firefly, the first of which are targeted for launch in 2015. Fireflies will conduct asteroid reconnaissance on the cheap. They'll be made from low-cost CubeSat components and will hitch a ride to space aboard rockets that also carry large communication satellites, Deep Space officials said. We can make amazing machines smaller, cheaper, and faster than ever before, Deep Space Chairman Rick Tumlinson said in a statement. Imagine a production line of Fireflies cocked and loaded and ready to fly out to examine any object that gets near the Earth. The Firefly fleet's work will pave the way for 70-pound spacecraft called Dragonfly, which will blast off beginning in 2016. These Dragonflies will bring asteroid samples back to Earth during missions that last 2 to 4 years. Some samples will help the company determine mining targets. Just for fun, can you imagine an asteroid the size of Rhode Island made of gold? The public will get to fly along with both probes, whose activities will likely be funded in some measure by corporate sponsorship. Interesting statements. And there is a quick audio link I'll share with you here.
Hi, everyone. This is Chris Lewicki, President and Chief Asteroid Miner here at Planetary Resources. We've been extraordinarily busy here at Planetary, and it's been a while since we've posted a tech update. I'm here at my desk in Bellevue, Washington, right outside Seattle, with one of the ARCID 100 mechanical prototypes that are under production here in the shop. The ARCID 100 is our space telescope and technology demonstrator for our prospecting missions. Now, one of the earliest decisions we made was to design and build as much as possible in-house, right here at Planetary. This is much the same way that Elon Musk and SpaceX have vertically integrated to drive innovation, control reliability, and to keep costs down. And this is going to allow us to mass produce our spacecraft at extremely low cost. The first thing I'd like you to notice about the ARCID 100 is that it's daringly small. This cuts the cost of deep space missions below anything we've become accustomed to. Our engineering team is packing tremendous capability into this small package, and this will give us more launch opportunities to get our spacecraft where they need to go in the solar system. So as I lift the prototype, you can see the density of everything that we've packed into these 11 kilograms, from our deployable solar arrays to the integrated avionics bay on the bottom and our instrument and sensor package at the back of the comparatively large optical assembly that really dominates the volume of the spacecraft. Of course, what you can't see is the innovations that we're developing in the flight software, but our software team will assure you that they exist. Without divulging our intellectual property, I can tell you that we're working to make this the most advanced spacecraft per kilogram that exists today. We're drawing on our experience from traditional and private space exploration and combining it with exponential technology developments of the past few years and those to come in the next few years. With all of this, we're raising the bar on spacecraft design above anything that's been done before. All right, let's go on a quick tour of PRI headquarters and head over to the clean room. Here in our Class 10,000 clean room and our Class 100 flow benches over there, we're focused on developing our spacecraft optics. One of the things that's unique about our optic is that it's multifunctional. Not only can we collect imagery over a wide range of wavelengths and intensities, but we also use it for laser communications, giving ourselves more option than the large dishes that have been used by the Deep Space Network to date. Let's take a closer look. In our LaserCom testbed, we're demonstrating tracking and pointing algorithms that will be essential for returning data to Earth. Now, this is important because our ARCID 200 and 300 prospecting spacecraft can be up to hundreds of millions of kilometers from Earth. And our small size, weight, and power don't allow traditional spacecraft communications technology, which is often as large as our entire spacecraft. And we're not the only ones who are interested in this. We're actually under contract to help this technology develop for NASA as well. Now, let's take a look at where our spacecraft are being manufactured. I'm in our manufacturing facility where we're building additional configuration prototypes. With each prototype build, we're learning a lot about how to strip cost out of the assembly, integration, and test process. And that will be incredibly valuable when we start mass production of these units destined for space. Here's one example of what I mean. We can use this computer-controlled mill to create single-piece parts that serve as the avionics box and other elements of the ARCID series, driving simplicity and tight integration into our vehicle. Our goal is to evolve a process that will allow just a few of our staff to deliver finished spacecraft in a very short amount of time. Fewer people, less time, means lower cost. Well, that's it for today. We'll keep you updated about things as they progress. There's a lot going on here. Thank you again for all your support, and it's good to know you're excited as we are about this critical series of missions and what they mean for creating abundance in space and here on Earth.
Very good. Thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio and sharing that with us. Deep Space Industries, Inc., keep up with their stock or look them up online and send them a resume because this company is going places. They're going to do stuff. In our economic science, I found this story absolutely irresistible because we're always looking for types and shadows, good examples, things that give us a path or a model to follow. And I would like to announce, it's just January of 2013, but I would like to announce the X Squared Radio nomination for the Nobel Prize for Economics. We nominate the president of Iceland, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, for the Nobel Prize in Economics. His country was the poster child for financial failure for the European Union, and now, 3 years later, they are up and running with almost no unemployment and no foreclosures. How did they do it? Well, you're not going to believe it. I thought I would share this link with you. This is his interview.
Well, so far, the only bit of hope that's come out of this Davos conference this year is from the Icelandic president, who's standing alongside me, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson. Mr. President, why are you such a beacon of hope? Why has Iceland survived where Europe has failed? What are you doing differently?
I think it surprises a lot of people that 4 years ago we were exhibit number one of a failed financial system. But now we are back on recovery with economic growth and very little unemployment. And I think the primary reason is that we were wise enough to realize this was also a fundamental social and political crisis. But above all, we didn't follow the traditional prevailing orthodoxies of the Western world in the last 30 years. We introduced currency controls. We let the banks fail.
Well, wait a minute. Did the president say we introduced currency controls and we let the banks fail? I thought that's what he said. Let's continue.
We provided support for the poor. We didn't introduce austerity measures of the scale you're seeing here in Europe. And the end result, 4 years later, is that Iceland is enjoying progress and recovery very different from the other European countries that suffered from the financial crisis.
But will your policy of letting the banks fail, would that have worked for the rest of Europe?
I think so, because as I'm often asked people, why do they consider the banks to be the holy churches of the modern economy? Why are private banks not like airlines and telecommunication companies allowed to go bankrupt if they have been conducted in an irresponsible way? The theory that you have to bail out banks is a theory about bankers enjoying for their own profit the success and then letting ordinary people bear the failure through taxes and austerity. And people in enlightened democracies are not going to accept that in the long run.
It wouldn't work for the UK with their reliance on the financial sector, though, would it?
Well, this is an interesting question, because one thing we learned after the collapse of the banks in Iceland, that the Icelandic banks, like the British and the Americans and other banks, have in fact become high-tech companies, hiring engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists. And when they failed, the innovative sectors of our economy, the IT sector, the high-tech sector, in fact blossomed and have been doing much better in the last 3 years than ever before. So the lesson of that is that if you want your economy to be competitive in the innovative sector of the 21st century, a strong financial sector that takes the talent from these sectors, even a successful financial sector, is in fact bad news if you want your economy to be competitive in the areas which really are the 21st century areas, innovation, technology, IT.
President Grímsson, thank you very much.
All right, there you go. That's my nomination for the Nobel Prize for Economics. I think it's a brilliant idea. Instead of making the taxpayers bail out the banks, which we did, and when they got the money, instead of paying off the debt, they just took it and squandered it. Millions of Americans, however, are following the advice that we have given out here at X Squared Radio. Either that or the richest depositors know something is up, and they are canning their money for deposits in the backyard. U.S. Federal Reserve is reporting a major deposit withdrawal from the nation's bank accounts. The financial system hasn't seen such a massive fund outflow since 9/11 attacks. The first week of January 2013 has seen $114 billion withdrawn from 25 of the U.S. biggest banks, pushing deposits down to $5.37 trillion, according to the U.S. Fed. I don't need to remind you that this is having a devastating impact on the money trading abilities of these banks. You see, they leverage your deposits by a factor of 20 or more to 1 and trade that cash hundreds of times a month to earn 30, 50, and even 60% interest on it. Of course, you can't borrow any of it because they write their own regulations to prevent you from qualifying for a loan of any kind. Try to buy a new car or home lately? Better chances at the lottery, actually. Financial analysts suggest it could be down to the Transaction Account Guarantee Insurance Program coming to an end on December 31st last year and clients moving their money that is no longer insured by the government. The insurance now does not cover any cash that is backed by a money market. The program was introduced in the wake of the 2008 crisis in order to support the banking system. It provided insurance for about $1.5 trillion in non-interest-bearing accounts with a limit of $250,000. It was aimed at medium and small banks, as the creators of the program believed bigger banks would cope with the crisis themselves. So the current fast pace of withdrawal comes as a surprise to financial analysts because the deposits are slipping away from those banks which supposedly were safe. Experts expected savers in small and medium banks would turn to bigger players come December 31st. The experts are also wrong. Silver, firearms, and food storage purchases are at an all-time high. Another set of data from the U.S. Federal Reserve shows some deposits may have moved within the banking system from one type of account to another. That, my friends, is pure propaganda. People want their cash in their own hands and have completely lost faith in the banking empires. I say it's about time. Now, I have a GMO update. This is going to take a little while, and it's fairly complicated. And we have done some GMO updates on this program before. And as I have told you before, I have some 40-page dossiers that have been put together, lots of evidence from Monsanto, from the FDA, and other organizations, and I will be happy to send it to you if you will write me. It's way too much to go over in a three-hour program, but it is it's quite voluminous and very detailed, and it makes the case very, very well. If you want it, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I'll be happy to send you what I have. Also, if you want to be part of the program tonight, you want to interact or discuss what's going on here tonight, you can call us toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-9537. And don't forget, our digital conference line is always up and running, and you can listen to BBS Radio, specifically X Squared Radio, by dialing 805-399-1000 and then the passcode 769-608 pound. The numbers are at the website at X Squared Radio or at bbsradio.com channel 2. All right, here we go. This is the GMO update. Regulators have discovered a hidden viral gene in commercial GMO crops. How should a regulatory agency announce they have discovered something potentially very important about the safety of products they have been approving for over 20 years? Well, I guess that depends on who's getting rich off of it. In the course of analysis to identify potential allergens in genetically modified organizations, specifically or organisms, specifically crops, the European Food Safety Authority, that's EFSA, has belatedly discovered that the most common genetic regulatory sequence in commercial GMOs also encodes a significant fragment of a viral gene. This finding has serious ramifications for crop biotechnology and its regulation, but possibly even greater ones for people who eat them and the farmers. Because there are clear indications that this viral gene, which is called gene 6, might not be safe for human consumption. Imagine that. The mighty Monsanto has not had the best interests of the human race in mind after all. What are they eating? Hermetically sealed Twinkies? Well, what the scientists have discovered is that of the 86 different transgenic events, these are unique insertions of foreign DNA into the plant organisms, commercialized to date in the United States, 54 of them contain portions of gene 6 within them. They include any with a widely used gene regulatory sequence called the CAMV35S promoter. And those of you that are familiar with botany will know exactly what that is. But for those of you who are not, it's a cauliflower mosaic virus. Okay? Among the affected transgenic events are some of the most widely grown GMOs, including Roundup Ready soybeans. Just so you know, Roundup Ready soybeans. It means that you can spray Roundup, which is an herbicide. It kills plants. You can spray Roundup on the soybeans, and it will kill everything except for the soybeans because they've been genetically engineered to be resistant to the chemical. That's why they're called Roundup Ready soybeans. And MON 810 maize, which is corn. They include the controversial NK603 maize. You've seen those signs out as you drive across the state of Nebraska on the side of the road. Recently reported as causing tumors in rats. Of course, the rats were highly overfed, and this is why it caused the tumors. The French report was very definitive, although the FDA threw out the report saying that the results were inconclusive. We covered that very well last month here on X Squared Radio. The researchers themselves concluded that the presence of segments of gene 6 might result in unintended phenotypic changes, quote unquote. I'll let that sink in just for a second. They reached this conclusion because similar fragments of gene 6 have already been shown to be active on their own. In other words, the EFSA researchers were unable to rule out a hazard to public health or the environment. In general, viral genes expressed in plants raise both agronomic and human health concerns, which were first expressed in public statements all the way back in 2008, 5 years ago. This is because many of the viral genes function to disable their host in order to facilitate the pathogen invasion. Often, once this is achieved by incapacitating specific antipathogen defenses, in other words, your immune system, incorporating such genes could clearly lead to undesirable and unexpected outcomes in agriculture. In other words, your plants could get the flu. Viruses that infect plants are often not that different from viruses that infect humans. Considering that viruses are highly subject to random mutations that facilitate survival and propagation, this is exceedingly risky for the human race. For example, sometimes the genes of human and plant viruses are interchangeable, while on other occasions, inserting plant viral fragments as transgenes has caused the genetically altered plant to become susceptible to an animal virus. And we've known about that since 2001, 12 years ago. In short, it's like an entire corn crop catching the flu from a human. Thus, in various ways, inserting viral genes into crop plants and the food supply confers a significant potential harm. That's putting it lightly. Well, here are the choices for regulators. Now, just so you know, we're not talking about a voltage regulator or a pressure regulator. We're talking about bureaucrats. We're talking about armies of government workers that work inside of government buildings, that live on government wages, that make decisions about what hits your supper table. The original discovery by the two scientists, and this is Potvin and Dujardin at EFSA, of Gene 6 in commercial GMO crops must have caused government regulators to begin sweating spinal fluid. They could, one, recall all the CAMV Gene 6 containing crops in Europe. That would mean revoking importation and planting approvals. Or, two, undertake a retrospective risk assessment of the CAMV promoter and its Gene 6 sequences and hope to give it a clean bill of health. In other words, retroactively going back over records and saying, oh, we thought that was a risk, but now it's okay. Well, it's easy to see the attraction for EFSA of option two. Recall would be a massive political and financial decision and would also be a huge embarrassment to the regulators themselves. It would leave very few GMO crops on the market, and it might even mean the end of crop biotechnology. Well, we can't have that, a la Monsanto. After all, Pandora's box is now growing on millions of acres all over the world, starting with third world populations. Regulators, bureaucrats, in principle at least, also have a third option to gauge the seriousness of any potential GMO hazard: GMO monitoring, which is required by EU regulations, ought to allow them to find out if deaths, illnesses, or crop failures have been reported by farmers or health officials and can be correlated with the Gene 6 sequence. Of course, they could have always have died of something else. I think I smell something besides rotting corn. Unfortunately, this particular avenue of inquiry is a scientific dead end. Not one country has carried through on promises to officially and scientifically monitor any hazardous consequences of GMO. I wonder why. Could it have anything to do with Monsanto millions fueling the Ferraris of the regulators who approved their Frankenfritters in the first place? Unsurprisingly, EFSA chose option two. However, their investigation resulted only in the vague and unreassuring conclusion that Gene 6, quote, might result in unintended phenotypic changes. This means literally that changes of an unknown number, nature, or magnitude may or may not occur. We're not saying. It falls well short of solid scientific reassurance, I can tell you that. Hold on one second while I check my notes. There we go. Okay. I guess no zombies have scourged downtown Atlanta yet, or three-eyed chickens have shown up at Bojangles, so there's no need for alarm yet. We'll let you know, after the fact, of course, of any unintended phenotypic changes in the maternity ward. Can the presence of a fragment of virus DNA really be that significant? Well, there are many functions of the mysterious Gene 6. Like most plant viral genes, it produces a protein that is multifunctional. It has four, so far, known roles in the viral infection cycle. The first is to participate in the assembly of virus particles. Now, there's no current data to suggest this function has any implications for biosafety. Not yet, anyway. The second known function is to suppress antipathogen defenses. In other words, your immune system. And that's been known since 2008. Thirdly, Gene 6 has the highly unusual function of transactivating the long RNA. Now, if you know anything about genetics, RNA is key to the function of your genetics, your genes. Fourthly, unconnected to these other mechanisms, Gene 6 has very recently been shown to make plants highly susceptible to bacterial pathogens. So they might hold up okay to Roundup, the chemical herbicide, but they don't hold up so well to bacterial infections. Gene 6 does this by interfering with a common antipathogen defense mechanism possessed by plants. These latter three functions of Gene 6 have vast implications. The article goes on, and I can get into the toxicity, but that's the politics of it. That's the science of it. And there are big lessons to learn. It's perhaps the most basic assumption in all of risk assessment. And when we're talking about Food and Drug Administration, there are very, very strict dictations on risk assessment. Those of you that work in the medical instrument business know this. It is dictated by the FDA. There are physicians involved in their risk assessment. And it always is compared to clinical, that's historical clinical information, or clinical information that's gained through great expense, and sometimes volunteers and lab animals, to gain data from. So the developer of a new product provides regulators with accurate information about what is being assessed, and then that goes through this very, very strict bunch of red tape to make sure things are safe for you. Unfortunately, if a lot of money is put behind it, sometimes these don't get as scrutinized as they should be. Major public universities, biotech multinationals, and government regulators everywhere seemingly did not appreciate the relatively simple possibility that the DNA constructs they were responsible for encoded a viral gene. They did appreciate, however, the bonus checks for the right decision on the regulations. This lapse occurred despite the fact that Gene 6 was not truly hidden. It was right there in your face. In the end, there is going to be no one to blame except those who sold food safety for cash. And they have excellent attorneys, and they cannot recall anything. The inability of risk assessment processes to incorporate long-standing and repeated scientific findings is every bit as worrisome as the fail to intellectually anticipate the possibility of overlapping genes when manipulating viral sequences. But what's a regulator to do? So much money, so little time to spend it. After all, if you catch the potato leaf virus and die ignominiously in a third world settlement, who's going to know? Biotechnology is often forgotten. It's not just a technology. It's an experiment in the proposition that human institutions can perform adequate risk assessments on novel living organisms. Rather than treat that question as primarily a daunting scientific one, we should for now consider that the primary obstacle will be overcoming the much more mundane trap of human greed, complacency, and incompetence. We're not there yet, and therefore this incident will serve to reinforce the demands for GMO labeling in places where it is absent. Don't forget, you Californians out there recently voted down GMO labeling of human food. Sometimes you reap what you sow. We have about 20 minutes. We're going to bring Stephanie Paulus on. Stephanie is a longtime racing resource. She worked in the industry with many of the race teams. I'm sure we're going to talk about some war stories tonight. And she's also involved in the Breakthrough Energy Movement. And the Breakthrough Energy Movement is a fine organization, people of very high consciousness that are working at their own expense and that of their investors to bring breakthrough energy technology to the consumer level. We want to see this in our homes, in our automobiles, in our businesses. We want to be able to have access to all this. Hold on one second. I have a note coming in from out there in cyber world. Yeah. All right. Well, Stephanie's ready, but I need about 19 more minutes. I'm going to get through the rest of this news, and then we'll bring her on. I can tell you right now it'll be worth it. Great personality, easy to communicate with, and one of the things that's missing in the energy business. Excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful ice-cold grapefruit juice. You know that we're dealing with a lot of Teslaites out there. And I would say that there's kind of a counterculture, sort of, I won't really say it, a chaos culture, but it's sort of like to heck with Edison culture. And that's putting it lightly. There are young, very bright, very passionate engineers that are trying to come up with great ideas. And there are the aging ones. I'm not dating myself, but they have attics and basements and shops out and back, and they worked as engineers or technicians their entire lives, and their companies really didn't want to pursue the great ideas that they had, so they played with them at home. And doggone it, if some of these ideas didn't work. So there are prototypes laying out there on bench tops everywhere. Now, they're not ready for prime time. You know, they're held together with a little baling wire and a little plexiglass. They won't withstand the shake and bake test, but they're accomplishing some pretty amazing things. Now, when you take these seasoned engineers who've been playing with these ideas since the late 40s, and you take these young, energetic, very bright society of automotive engineer Teslaites, and you put them together, you get a formidable army, albeit not very well funded. And that's what the Breakthrough Energy movement is all about. That's why Stephanie got involved. Her passion and her expertise at being able to organize teams and win races, that's where competition, the real American spirit, really shines. To organize race teams and make them win takes a special talent. We call it race day. Sometimes we put the electric trucks together and we go out to trade shows, and, well, sometimes it's not a pretty day. It's raining. We can't find the chain binders. We have a flat on the trailer. We have a bearing go out 200 miles down the road. You have to pull the wrenches out, roll your sleeves up, fix it on the road. It's race day. That's the way it is when you race. When the race starts, there's no, okay, hold on, wait, because Mr. Earnhardt isn't ready yet. Sorry about that. When the show starts, you got to be ready to dance. And that takes not only a great amount of organization and money, it also takes a great determination and a great personality to drive that and manage that. You're gonna hear that when Stephanie comes on in about 15 minutes. Now, I have some sort of political news. We don't really like to do a whole lot of politics here, although we love political science. One of the things that happened last year is that the executive branch made 3 appointments without the advice and consent of the Senate. Well, to put it another way, the Senate wasn't really being cooperative. Oh, the majority party was, but the minority party was not. And they were not able to, the executive branch was not able to get the appointments that it wanted put in place. So what did it do? Well, it didn't wait for a full recess. A recess is when everyone goes home. They kind of waited for a quiet day. I mean, regular Senate business was going on. But President Barack Obama violated the Constitution when he bypassed the Senate to fill vacancies on a labor relations panel. A federal appeals court panel ruled Friday. 3-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit said that Obama did not have the power to make 3 recess appointments last year to the National Labor Relations Board. The unanimous decision is an embarrassing setback for the president, who made the appointments after Senate Republicans spent months blocking his choices for an agency they contended was biased in favor of unions. I think we also contend that as well. The ruling also throws into question Obama's recess appointment of Richard Cordray to head the new organization, the new bureaucracy called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Cordray's appointment, also made under the recess circumstance, has been challenged in a separate case. We expect that one to be struck down as well. Obama claims he acted properly in the case of the NLRB appointments because the Senate was away for the holidays on a 20-day recess, but not all the Senate was gone. They were running business as usual. And believe me, when the Democrats are running business as usual, if the GOP had tried this, it would have been war. The Obama administration is expected to appeal the decision, but they will lose. Just more political falderal going on up there. Also in the news, we love it when the past meets the future. Gleaming where it sank almost 3,000 years ago, a golden bracelet from the Bronze Age marks the site of one of the world's oldest shipwrecks, recently discovered off the coast of the United Kingdom. At the time of the wreck, Rome had yet to be built. Pharaohs still ruled Egypt, and Jesus Christ's birth was still centuries away. The treasure was part of a 900 BC cargo discovered in May of 2009 near the town of Salcombe by divers from the Southwest Maritime Archaeological Group, announcing this month at the International Shipwreck. Let me see. Hold on one second here. All right, I sent her a note just to make sure that she's ready to go. This is buried for centuries in a field in central England. There's a finely worked 1,300-year-old fragment of a gold plate that was revealed today as part of the largest Anglo-Saxon hoard ever found, showing two eagles flanking a fish. The Dark Ages treasure was one of more than 1,500 scattered gold and silver artifacts unearthed in July by metal detector enthusiast Terry Herbert on his friend's farm near the town of Burtwood. I hope they got the whole treasure. The quantity of gold is amazing, but more importantly, the craftsmanship is consummate. Kevin Leahy of the London-based Portable Antiquities Scheme said in a statement, the group records archaeological objects discovered by amateur treasure hunters in the UK. This was the very best that the Anglo-Saxon metalworkers could do, and they were very good. Also coming up from the past, you know, we have said on this program in years past, and I believed myself, that Neanderthals, and I think we published it in our second volume of The Ark of Millions of Years, Neanderthals are not part of the human genetic trait. They're a separate race. Cro-Magnons, yes, but not Neanderthals. But the next time you're tempted to call some oaf a Neanderthal, hey, you might still do it, but you might also want to take a look in the mirror. According to new DNA study, most humans have a little Neanderthal in them, at least 1-4% of a person's genetic makeup. The study uncovered the first solid genetic evidence that modern humans, or Homo sapiens, interbred with their Neanderthal neighbors, who mysteriously died out about 30,000 years ago. What's more, the Neanderthal modern human mating, apparently, took place in the Middle East, shortly after modern humans had left Africa, not in Europe, as had long been suspected. We can now say that in all probability there was a gene flow from Neanderthals to modern humans, lead study author Ed Green of the University of California, Santa Cruz, said in a prepared statement. That's no surprise to anthropologist Eric Trinkhouse, whose skeleton-based claims of Neanderthal-modern human interbreeding, previously contradicted with DNA evidence, appear to have been vindicated by the new gene study, to be published tomorrow in the journal Science. They've finally seen the light, because it's been obvious to many of us that this happened, said Trinkhouse of Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, who wasn't part of the study. Trinkhouse adds that most living humans probably have much more Neanderthal DNA than the new study suggests. 1 to 4% is truly a minimum, Trinkhouse added. But is it 10%, 20%? I have no idea. The genetic team reached their conclusion after comparing the genomes of 5 living humans from China, France, Papua New Guinea, Southern Africa, and Western Africa against the available rough draft of the Neanderthal genome. And they didn't take anybody from South Carolina, though. Oh, well. The results showed that the Neanderthal DNA is 99.7% identical to modern human DNA versus, for example, 98.8% for modern humans and chimps, according to the study. In addition, all modern ethnic groups other than Africans carry traces of Neanderthal DNA in their genomes, the study says, which at first puzzled the scientists. Though no fossil evidence has been found for Neanderthals and modern humans coexisting in Africa, Neanderthals, like modern humans, are thought to have arisen on the continent. If you told an archaeologist that you'd found evidence of gene exchange between Neanderthals and modern humans and asked them to guess which living population it was found in, most would say Europeans, because there's well-documented archaeological evidence that they lived side by side for several thousand years. For another thing, Neanderthals never lived in China or Papua New Guinea in the Pacific region of Malaysia. Or Melanesia, according to the archaeological record. But the fact is that Chinese and Melanesians are as closely related to Neanderthals as Europeans, said Reich, a population geneticist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard University. So, how did modern humans with Neanderthal DNA end up in Asia and Melanesia? Neanderthals, the study team says, probably mixed with early Homo sapiens just after they left Africa, but before Homo sapiens split into different ethnic groups and scattered around the globe. That's assuming that we all sort of lived on one main continent and then migrated on foot around the planet. That's a big assumption. The first opportunity for interbreeding probably occurs about 60,000 years ago in Middle Eastern regions adjacent to Africa, where archaeological evidence shows the two species overlapped for a time, the team says. And it wouldn't have taken much mating to make an impact, according to study co-author Reich. The results could stem from a Neanderthal-modern human one-night stand or from thousands of interspecies assignments. It's hard to tell. The new study isn't alone in finding genetic hints of Homo sapiens. Genetic anthropologist Jeffrey Long, who calls the study science study very exciting, co-authored a new, not yet published study that found DNA evidence of interbreeding between modern humans and an archaic human species, although it's not clear which. let's see. Oh yeah, one more thing I want to cover before we bring Stephanie on. I have to write her again and make sure that she can accept BBS Radio's Skype request. I think she's listening right now, so maybe she'll just do that. Natural selection has reared its head again. I'm not going to call it evolution. It's natural selection. Lower jaw teeth in frogs re-evolved after an absence of, 200 million years, a new study says. One of more than 6,000 species of frogs, only one out of 6,000 species of frogs, a South American marsupial tree frog called Gastrotheca guentheri has teeth on both its upper and lower jaws. Most frogs have only tiny upper jaw teeth. A new analysis of the frog family tree reveals that the common ancestor of frogs which had long lower jaw teeth, lost them more than 230 million years ago before eventually going extinct. You see, the thing about natural selection is that species will randomly mutate according to the theory, and it's been fairly well proven inside of species, will randomly mutate, and if that mutation gives that species a survivability advantage, like a tail or teeth or the ability to see in the dark, then that will survive and it will continue to breed into that species, and then the species will diverge. This discovery runs counter to a principle called Dolo's Law, which states that physical structures lost during evolution are never regained, according to Wiens, an evolutionary biologist at Stony Brook University in New York State. In fact, the teeth's reappearance may have exposed the law's loophole. That is, much easier to re-evolve things if you're already making them somewhere else, Wiens said. In other words, the frog didn't have to make teeth on the lower jaw from scratch because they're already making them on the upper jaw. Sounds like biological hooey to me. In general, losing complex features is common in evolution. Humans and frogs have lost their tails. Most snakes have lost limbs. Birds and turtles have lost teeth, according to the study. But in the past 8 years or so, more studies have found evidence of these advanced characteristics springing up again. For instance, wings in stick insects and fingers and toes in lizards. In his study, Wiens used statistical methods to trace the evolution of teeth on the family tree of 170 amphibian species to frogs' common ancestor. The scientists used a combination of data, including DNA sequences from modern frogs as well as amphibian fossils. Sounds like a good design of experiment. An alternative theory is that lower jaw teeth were lost in hundreds of other frog species, but not the Guentheri species. It is not impossible, but it is just much, much more likely that teeth were lost once and regained once, said Wiens, whose study appeared online in January in the journal Evolution. Gunther Wagner, an evolutionary biologist at Yale University, said that of all the recent research questioning Dolo's Law, this is probably the one that is least disputable. Some of it was luck, he noted. Wiens found an animal that is isolated enough on the family tree that the results are strong and unassailable, said Wagner, who was not involved in the study. It's a very clear case of reacquisition of a lost complex morphological structure, which, according to current thinking, should not be possible. Less certain, however, is why the teeth came back. That was my original point. If you don't have some kind of advantage that's provided by the teeth, why grow them back? In many frogs, teeth aren't that crucial because they grab their food by their tongue. The animals generally rely on stealth and being able to snag something out of the air with the tongue. They don't use the fang-like teeth. The fact that tooth-like structures appear more often than real teeth means that tooth evolution doesn't automatically occur when the need arises. So why would they grow it back? It's not enough to explain why the marsupial tree frog regained its lower teeth. I can confidently say that we just don't know. That's what I'm saying. All right, let's take a quick, let's take a 5 or 6 minute break. We'll listen to a little Leonard Cohen, and we'll be back with Stephanie Paulus. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming right after this.
David played in it.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad you could join us. Sometimes we have technical difficulties with the internet. That's not our fault. My guest right now is going to be Stephanie Paulson, Paulus. She is a multidimensional person, as I have described for the past hour. Welcome to the program, Stephanie. Well, I had her, and then I don't have her. Let's see. I don't know what to do there. She should be in on the network. Well, we can just wing it and go forward here. As I was talking about why is she trying to call me when she should be on with the group conversation? I don't know what to do here. Hold on one moment, please. Just anyway, using camera traps to take photographs mechanically, as well as taking photographs personally, Gaschak has captured what few have been able to see with their own eyes. As you know, Chernobyl was the site of the terrible nuclear catastrophe in 1986. People don't live there anymore. Some 300,000 people have been evacuated out of that area. One of the first rescuers on the site of the nuclear disaster, Gaschak, has devoted recent years to photographing lynxes, otters, owls, and other wildlife, and even has discovered the footprints of brown bears. The exclusive zone stretches for miles around the side of the reactor, including Pripyat, which was once a thriving Soviet town of 50,000 inhabitants, but has remained a ghost town since the disaster. A time warp of perestroika era Soviet life. I don't know. Was Stephanie on and then she dropped off, or she's showing that she's on? She's tried to call me three times, so she should be on. Stephanie, are you there? No. Okay. We'll wait a couple more minutes and see if she'll come in. More than 300,000 people were evacuated from the region in the aftermath of the explosion, and only a few hundred stubborn pensioners have returned, defying government bans on settlement inside the zone. All right, now let's see if Stephanie is there. Stephanie, are
Hello
you
there?
Aha, there she is.
There you are. Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
We're doing great. We're doing great. I love technology and I love live radio because we just have the most fun with this. Sometimes it's challenging and today is no different. Sometimes it goes smooth as clockwork and it's just boring. And I think that's one of the reasons why people like listening to BBS radio, because it really is live radio. You don't hear any of this on, you know, the more pre-recorded or canned radio programs. And so sometimes they go, well, let's listen to the bloopers that are on BBS radio. It's cool. We like it. We've been here 8 years. How are you, Stephanie? Well, I don't know. She should be there. I don't know. She was there and now she's not. So I don't know what to do. We'll just keep on with the All right. Well, according to a book on there she is. Where were you?
Oh, Brooks, I'm just sitting here listening to you. How are you, honey?
I'm good. I'm good. So now you're really here. We're listening to you. I can hear your voice.
I'm really here, and I've been listening to you for the past hour.
Interesting news today. We covered it from a little different point of view, but it's mine, so it's the way I like it. Is Le Mans going on this week?
No, it's not. We're looking at the 24 Hours of Grand Am.
Oh, Grand Am. That's right. You know, I was talking about race day earlier. We still use that terminology, even though we don't do much racing anymore, other than pacing races with our electric vehicles. But we still have the same strain. Like, we're going to go to a trade show or something. Everything still has to come together. Everything still has to work. All the loose wires and door pins and everything have to be in place. You know, what's it like living in that environment with where every week is race day? I think your mic's cutting out because I heard you say and then nothing. So I know you're listening, but I need to hear your voice. Just because millions of people are listening doesn't mean you have to be shy.
Every day that is race day, it's like adrenaline is 24/7, and you're standing on the and you're stand adrenaline. Okay, adrenaline is 24. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, adrenaline is 24/7. You're standing on the touch of the start-finish line. No, I'm not shy at all, and you know that.
I know. Are you hearing an echo? Or are you listening through your computer, or do you have a headset on?
You know.
You're probably listening to the program in a time delay, because it's about delayed like 1 or 2 minutes sometimes. So you probably need to turn your speaker off on your computer and listen to the Skype call instead of the radio program.
How's that? Does that work better?
Yeah, much better, much better, much interactive.
Is that better?
Yes, that's better. Are you listening to me on your Skype call, or are you listening to the radio broadcast on bbsradio.com?
Do you know what? Brooks, I'm on Skype. And I'm going to tell you that listening and watching and feeling... Okay. The 24 Hours of Le Mans... The 24 Hours of Le Mans that just finished. I'm listening. I'm on Skype. Skype. Is it?
Yeah, you're on Skype. I can hear you crystal clear. Are you okay?
You sure? And I'm sorry for your listeners, and I apologize. Standing on the start-finish line.
It's a lot of noise and a lot of stress, and there's people are watching, and they're not going to give you any kind of break. When it comes time to hit the start switch, you have to start or they push you off to the side, right?
Okay, let's correct that. The 24 Hours of Grand Am that just finished in Daytona.
Stephanie and I talk all the time on the phone, but usually it's just me and her. There's nobody listening in, so I know exactly what this is like.
Yes.
Yeah, it's okay. It's one of the strange things that's happening in the new energy field. Is we have all these diverging personalities. We have the very strong egos of the inventors. We have investors who want to get on the ground floor of the next greatest technology. And we have people that are interested in manufacturing and bringing things to market. But what's really lacking is the people to bring all those people together and make them work together. And that's what Stephanie does. She is working with people who are putting on conferences, people who are coming up with technology, people who have money, people who do marketing, and she kind of brings them all together behind the scenes and works with each of them and gets them all to the show at the same time. So what do you think is your greatest challenge in pulling that together? Is it the strong personalities, or is it the elusive technology that sometimes doesn't make it to the show? Well,
it's very simple. Let me put it this way. Bruce, it's both. Brooks, I got to tell you, we got to go to the next level. If we're going to go racing in the next 2 to 3 years, we have to get into alternative energies. We have to get into...
By alternative energies, you mean cars that run on different kinds of energy than gasoline and diesel fuel?
Yes.
You know, I have a friend here in town. He owns Charlotte Motor Speedway. Actually, his family does. He runs the organization. His name is Marcus Smith. And, yeah, you know him. I mean, his dad is a legend, Bruton Smith, and of course his brother David Smith runs Sonic Automotive, which is correct. A large. Yeah.
Let me jump in there.
Sure.
I have been challenged by the best in the motorsports world to take us to the next level. And between you, me, and the Marcus of the worlds, we need to take them onto alternative energy.
Well, I mean, they have had, you know, like electric car races at the plant or at the racetrack, but he said they're not loud, and that's part of the thing that people come for is the noise, the smell of burning, you know, unleaded gas. By the way, they just went to unleaded gas like a year ago. They've been running leaded gas in NASCAR for a long, long since the early days, but they won't go to methanol, and that's just crazy. It's just such a old, you know, big boys kind of pride that they can't get over. I told him, I'll bring an electric car out here that'll run faster than the NASCAR cars and leave them in the dust. Of course, they won't make any noise. So is it going to be interesting to watch alternative fuel or alternative energy cars race? I know there are guys out there building electric airplanes. That would scare me, I think, just the idea that, you know, the warning buzzer could go off that says, you need to recharge your airplane. What? I'm a long way from the airport yet. What do you mean I got to recharge my airplane? It's not like running out of fuel in a car where you coast safely to the right-hand side. But an airplane? I don't know. What would you do?
Well, I tell you what, Brooks.
Yes. We've had long, great conversations in all kinds of conditions. It's just you and me. I just relax a little bit. Everything will be okay.
Brooks, when we get to the point where we're ready to test high-performance cars, I've got chassis from F1, CART, NASCAR, Grand-Am that have been donated to do this. So when we're ready, it's there. So let's go.
Well, I have an electric motor that'll make 2,000 horsepower. I don't know how far it will run on a charge, but it'll go a few times around a racetrack. How much do these cars weigh? My truck weighs 2,600 pounds without a person in it. I am having the same difficulty. So I think what we're going to do is just pick this up another time. I've got enough content to get through the rest of the program. Occasionally, you know, we're getting a coherent sound, but I think we're still having technical difficulties. So I think what we'll do is we'll thank Stephanie very much for her appearance tonight. We'll do it another time when we have more preparation. So I appreciate it very much, Stephanie. That's okay. I've been there myself. So we'll pick it up another time. That was Stephanie Paulus. She's a great help and a great assistance in the Breakthrough Energy movement, and she's doing a great job for us. By the way, I have an article I call Rome Was Not Built in a Day. And there's some the thing about it is that there's an abuse of power going on in political science today. And I think all of America sees that. Although I have to say some people are happy about it. They believe that the checks and balances that we have set up in our government are just an obstacle to getting things done. And that it's time that just one person just comes in and just knocks everything out of the way and does things on their own. Well, that's not the way our republic is set up. Our republic is set up to be representative, you know, by the people. The president violated the Constitution when he made three appointments, you know, above and beyond the Constitution while Senate was still in session. The Senate, you know, has the constitutional duty to offer advice and consent. And admittedly, they didn't want to do it because they didn't like the president's choices. So they just ruled against him. Well, Washington has been drifting in a way that the founding fathers were afraid of in the very beginning. This article I call Rome Was Not Built in a Day. In an hour-long special run for the first time on national television this weekend, Schweitzer, the president of the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Institute, highlighted how the permanent political class that relies on lobbying and influence peddling makes more money by growing the size of government, which leaves no incentive on either side of the aisle to limit government. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I don't mean the Senate, and I don't mean the Congress. I mean the armies of bureaucrats, and I mean the armies of lobbyists that go with them. You see, when a congressman is elected, he serves for 2 years, and if he wins another election, he serves for another 2 years, and so on and so forth. If he's there for a long, long time, he moves up in the committees and he establishes a kind of dynasty. Well, it doesn't stop there, because the wives of the senators and congressmen also become connected, and the children and the cousins and the brothers and sisters and even the parents of elected officials become sort of satellite lobbyists, sort of like court-appointed advisors. And so businesses that are trying to do business with the government love to make friends with the friends or the family of those who are in control of grants and loans and ones that can sign business up for their companies. Now, when the founding fathers designed our nation's capital, they chose the architecture of ancient Rome to offer the appearance of ancient wisdom to the rest of the world. That was their reason behind it. Otherwise, they would have built log cabins. The hope was that our nation would also inherit some of the stature of its ancient pattern as well. Against all hopes of the founding fathers, however, modern Rome has become the drunken gluttons, just like its cousins of old. I guess it doesn't matter what language you speak. The language of money overpowers everything. As a result, the three richest counties and seven of the top 10 wealthiest counties in the nation are, guess where? Washington, D.C. The district also consumes the most fine wine in the nation. The most successful Lamborghini and Ferrari dealerships are also in D.C. The average wage in D.C. among the political class, $475,000 a year. Schweitzer asserts the business in Washington is now not politics, but money. The goal is to get there, get yours, and get out, without letting the cameras catch you in the process. Bannon, the executive chairman of Breitbart News, said the best and the brightest now come to Washington because they see Washington as a Tammany Hall that will allow them to get rich off influence peddling. He noted that Washington, D.C. runs the equivalent of a $4 trillion private equity fund every year and essentially doles out 25% of the country's wealth to those who are connected. The addiction to greed, however, has become so powerful that once the elected officials and their wives and kids and cousins are done, all the tax revenue is gone, and they borrow another trillion or so from generations of future taxpayers. It's gotten so bad that they are now borrowing from taxpayers who aren't even born yet. It's about time someone became the people's paparazzi and started exposing these family troops of lobbyists who are coming to town with just enough money for cab fare and leaving with enough to upgrade the lifestyle of their progeny for generations to come. This is a permanent political class that has now formed an aristocracy. The saddest part of all is that they have stolen enough money to pay for a permanent professional voter class that will keep sending these gluttons back to Washington. You, the voter, are to blame for the Plutarchs of Foggy Bottom. That's why nothing has changed in Washington. Until we, the people, shake off the shackles of ignorance and sweep the houses of government clean, we will drink the raw sewage of slavery. We don't need to fire a shot. We don't need to carry a single sign or miss a single day's work to do this. All you have to do is find decent people to run for public office and vote for them. You have 19 months to save your republic. All right, enough said about that. There is now a new way to scan planets. That's right. You can actually scan a planet and you can find out a lot about it. University of Leicester, planetary scientists have found new evidence suggesting auroras, similar to Earth's aurora borealis, occur on bodies outside our solar system. That's right. Auroras occur on several planets within our own solar system, and the brightest on Jupiter are 100 times brighter than those on Earth. However, no auroras have been observed beyond Neptune. Auroras occur when charged particles in an object's magnetosphere collide with atoms in its upper atmosphere, causing them to glow. However, before hitting the atmosphere, these particles also emit radio waves into space, which could provide us with key information about the length of the day of the planet's day, the strength of its magnetic field, how the planet interacts with its parent star, and even whether it has any moons. A new study led by Dr. Nichols, a lecturer and research fellow in the University of Leicester's Department of Physics and Astronomy, has shown, hang on a second here, I'm having a note come in. Who's it coming in from? Let's see. Let me go to this other channel here. One second, please. Just bear with me. Trying to read at the same time. Ah, here we go. Let's see what we got here. Ah. All right, I think we can try to continue this interview instead of doing it on Skype. We'll try it on phone. Hold on one second. I'm almost finished with this. The study, Origin of Electron Cyclotron Master, or MASER, Induced Radio Emissions on Ultra-Cool Dwarfs, Magnetosphere-Ionosphere Coupling Currents. Wow, try to say that really fast. Which recently appeared in the Astrophysical Journal, shows that this phenomenon is not limited to our solar system. It also shows that the radio emissions from a number of ultra-cool dwarfs, now that's a good name for a rock band, may be caused in a very similar but significantly more powerful way to Jupiter's auroras. I think it's cool, the fact that we can scan planets by looking at the radio waves that are put off even by invisibly by the auroras that occur in their upper atmosphere. Even if they don't emit light, they emit radio waves. I think that's cool. Hey, let's see if we can put Stephanie on the phone and see if we can continue the interview, because I found it fascinating. Stephanie, are you there?
I'm here, Brooks. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Sorry for the technical difficulties with Skype. It's sometimes it behaves and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, it's all good. It's all good.
One of the things that I see or saw as the challenge when I got involved in alternative energy back in 2006 when I retired from Major Auto was the things that Major Auto does very well. That is to say, the organizing of lots of different skill sets to hammer out a car from flat steel and it rolls off the end, something that people can drive reliably for 100,000 miles, was missing from the alternative energy field. And so I decided to bring that to the business. But the other pieces, the organizing of ego and high technology and competitiveness, that's your forte. You did that in the racing industry for a long, long time. How do you get all those two-fisted, beer-drinking, wrench-pulling personalities to work together on race day?
Well, thank you, Bert. It's called intuitive marketing. And you know what? If you have to look at your client, the product, what they're trying to promote, and what is feasible. And my heart and soul lies in racing. What we can do 20, 30, 40, 100 years from now. And it's not with petrol. It's with alternative energy. And you and I both know where this is going.
Well, I think so. And I haven't really seen an electric car race. I would think that other than the sound of rubber breaking or losing traction around the corners and maybe in heavy periods of acceleration. What's the noise? What could people expect with high-speed electric racing?
You know what? We can let the petrol and the torque and the propulsion go away. As long as we have the noise and the smell and the excitement and the adrenaline, then we're A-okay. That can all be illusions. And that can all be part of the ambiance, and that can all be part of the marketing. As long as we produce a racing venue that is eco-efficient and that is conducive to what you and I look at as far as zero point or breakthrough energy, then that's what it's about. And I've been challenged by, believe it or not, the hierarchy of the cart entourage that went into IRL and Grand Am, and in fact, I was at the 24 Hours of Le Mans a year ago asking me, what is our next step? What is our next step? How can we keep racing? How can we afford to do this? And that's what you and I are talking about. And that's our compassion. And that's our passion. And that's what we need to pursue.
I live close enough to Charlotte Motor Speedway that I could put the race on TV and open my door and listen to it.
Right. You sure can. As we speak, I've got emails coming in, and I don't know what time it is your time, but it is, let's see, my time is 7:49 Mountain Time. And I've got emails coming in saying, this is who won. My best friend, Larry Henry, who was a track announcer for 24 Hours of Grand Am. And, you know, he's saying, you know, it's just not the same. What can we do? We need to do something further.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, for me, growing up in racing, and, of course, I've been in the automotive industry my entire life, and some of those racing innovations do end up in the production vehicles, mostly in Cadillacs and Corvettes. But for me, they're 200-mile-an-hour billboards, because there's so much money required to run a race team. You need at least a couple of million dollars a quarter to run a race team of that size. And so Tide and Red Man and, you know, even Viagra. I mean, just about everything that you could think of that you could plaster on a car is what runs around that track.
Right. I took two teams to the 24 Hours of Le Mans a couple of years ago, and it literally took me $10 million for two cars to make their presence on that track.
Wow.
Now, you know what? That's great. And they were entrepreneurs, and they were privateers, and they're probably no longer on the racetrack. But you know what? That's sad. They need to be there. Those are the people with passion, and those are the people that promote our industry. But up and beyond that, we need to go a step further and create an industry that is pollutant-free, that is eco-conducive, and that is something that the public can absolutely enjoy without regret.
Well, when I was out at Miller Motor Park is out in Tooele, Utah, and it's a world-class four-and-a-half-mile road racing course for GT3 cars. These are 135 to 165 mile an hour road racing cars, Porsches and Supras and stuff like that. And I was talking to the track president named Mitchell or Mitch Wright, and I said, Mitch, I can build 10 of our electric sports cars, and we can take on the GT3 class cars for 10 laps, 45 miles on this track. 10 of our cars against 10 of your Porsches. And we will come in 1st through 10th, and your cars will come in 11th through 20th. He said, we would sponsor that, and we would put it on ESPN, and we would race heads up against your electric cars. Now, that would be an event that people would want to see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So where did it go?
Well, I went nowhere because obviously I couldn't raise the money to build the 10 race cars. But
well, then, you know what, Brooks? We need to raise that money. It's important. This is not only an occupation, but something that the American public loves to watch. And Brooks, you have done more for the alternative energy vehicle components than anyone I've ever known in my life. So what's next? Where can we go from here?
Well, I appreciate that. I've tried to go after the practical end while my colleagues, Elon Musk, you know, God bless him, he's been a great icon for the electric. He took the high-powered sports car level, the Lotus, and took it that way. I'm taking it the other way with a small electric truck. But we could build a little two-seater sports car that can go 45 miles on a charge at about 170 miles an hour.
Okay. All right. Well, let's say that this is a done deal. We take it to a series, say a Le Mans or a Petit Le Mans, Grand Am, IRL. Where do we go from there?
Well, Le Mans is too fast. I mean, you're talking 200 mile an hour cars, and they run 4 hours.
Petit Le Mans. You're in the U.S. Petit Le Mans, which is 150.
Well,
120, 150.
The difference between a Raven, which is our sports car, if you go to visionmotorcars.com, you can see it, and a GT3 Porsche is in the gearing. The GT3 Porsche has a very, very tall first gear in a five-speed transmission, which means it's like a 0 to 85 miles an hour in first gear. And then you get the other four gears on top of that, and they're fairly close.
True.
That 0 to 85 miles an hour is really slow in those cars. And if you're doing road racing, a lot of the corners are 40 or 50 mile an hour corners. Otherwise, you just spin out. Accelerating out of those corners is what those cars do worse. And our electric vehicles would slingshot out of those corners.
Okay. Now, where I'm coming from, and I come from the other side, I come from the marketing, the public relations, and the touchy-feely side. They're looking for the senses. They're looking for smell. The smell of the octane, the feel of the vibration and the hearing, gear one to gear five to gear six. You know, we can do this with a component like you're talking about. And it's all installed. Isn't this something that you and I talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the components that's missing from the electric vehicle business right now is what we call charge as you drive technology. That's what's missing.
Yes.
We got batteries, and the batteries are getting better, and hopefully they're going to get cheaper. Right now they're still pretty darn expensive for a 300 amp hour battery. You're still on upwards of 85, 90 cents an amp hour, which is pretty darn expensive. You're spending about as much for a battery pack as most people spend for a car.
Well, so, I got to tell you, if we can come up with this sound, feel, smell, and touch, we've got a done deal. And I'm putting it back in your lap because I knew you, the man, could do it.
Well, I'm afraid
I'm just, only I'm smell serious. I'm throwing it back here in. I'm throwing it back in your pit. We need to get this done.
I was in Greg Biffle's pit when he was in the Bush series.
Yeah.
Before he joined the big boys, and there was about three laps left, and they were under caution. And all the cars were lined up, and they were doing their, 55 miles an hour, and they were under caution. And I think Biffle was like 18th. And for those of you that know racing strategy, they're pitting at exactly the right moment is the key to winning
crucial.
A race. Yeah.
Yes.
As you're coming around to the entrance of the pits, you are just entering the straightaway. Which, when the cars enter the straightaway, when the pit car gets to within about 100 yards of the central line, the starting flag can step out and give them the green flag. If they give them the green flag, then the cars accelerate out, and by the time they get to the end or entering turn one, they're doing about 140
right.
miles an hour.
Right.
If you pit at that moment, you're going to lose the race. But if they do another lap, it is the perfect time to pit. Well, this Biffle's in 18th place, which is out of the money. You have to be in the first 12 places in NASCAR to be in the money. He's out of the money. His tires are fried. So is everyone's tires. There's three laps to go, but everyone's going to go. Biffle pits. I mean, literally at the last possible second, he makes a sharp left-hand turn, dumps into the pits, rolls down at 55 miles an hour, goes into his pit, gets all four tires, and they don't get the green flag. Sure enough, he gets out of the pits, makes it to the end of pit row, and slides right back into the group. They get green-lighted on the next lap, and he was on his way to taking
there
first
go.
Place. He lacked about 40 yards of taking first place in that race. He got second. That was the strategy. And I was in the pits when he came in, when those tires were sizzling when he came in. And they zipped those tires out, and he was out in about 11 seconds flat. That was so cool.
Amazing. Well, Brooks, my challenge from all my friends that own teams and are drivers is to, and they know this in their heart, what is our next step? How can we take this to the next level and stay racing? They know that Petro is on its way out. They know that they can't afford this after maybe two or three or four more years. How can we keep racing? How can we keep going fast? How's the adrenaline going to keep pumping?
That's a really good question. I don't know. If you have 53 cars out there that are all electric, it's not going to be a very noisy race. Although I got to say, if you go to championship racing, you don't really hear the car because they're going so fast. You don't hear the car until the car gets right beside you. Then you hear
Brooks,
off an hour.
I got to tell you, I started my racing career in '81 with the RX-7 Mazda Wankel engine, and no one heard me coming, going, in between, passing, or whatever. And I always came in podium, and there was no noise. But I got to tell you, there is noise that is involved. You need to have that for the ambience, for the crowd. You know, and we can create that, but we can also create it with the 0 point that you're talking about.
Yeah, we probably could. We could create a turbine that goes on the motor that gives it a sound.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we never knew whether my car was on or off unless I looked at the light on the gauge.
Yep.
I mean, it was that critical.
By the way, Brad Sorensen is the guy that designed the original RX-7. And
yeah,
he's on.
I had the second RX-7 in the United States, and it was just unbelievably awesome.
He's on.
I totally respect what he did.
He's on my design team.
Pardon me?
I said Brad Sorensen's on my design team.
Well, you know what? He has my deepest respect because that's one of my most incredible favorite cars of all times.
I had a Mazda RX-7. It was a 1993, but it had a small block Chevy in it. Now that was fun.
Well, I got to tell you something. It got me in a lot of trouble, and I learned the I-70 cops and I became very fond friends. Let me tell you, between Kansas City and Denver, there was just about 5 stops in between.
The neat thing about the Wankel engine, that was originally a General Motors engine, and they were going to put it in the 1975 Corvette, a four-rotor engine. They could never make it work. So they sold the engine to Mazda, and Mazda put it in the RX-2 and then the RX-3, which were backfiring menaces because they had so much, such a rich exhaust. They had to have a sparking system in the exhaust. But then the RX-7 came out, and it had a four-barrel carburetor on it, two rotors, and it ran like a scalded ape. But it got terrible fuel mileage. And it wasn't until, I believe it was 1982 that they went to a fuel-injected model, and that thing was scary fast.
You know what? I have a deep amount of respect for Mazda. I spent a fair amount of time over in Japan, over at Honda and Mitsubishi and all of the Oriental manufacturers. So you know what, it is what it is, but we just need to keep the public knowing that we're going to keep 0 point in the motor and the racing industry in our foresight. And, you know, I've stayed out of the industry for about a year now, and I keep getting emails from all my beautiful peers and the people that I traveled with and saying, what are you doing? What are you up to? I hear you're in the quote, stealth technology when it comes to racing. Please let us know what's going on. And you know what? My response to them is, stay tuned. We're still racing, and we're going to go fast no matter what.
Yeah, I think so. There's a guy out there on the West Coast. He's kind of a maverick, and he's put out some YouTubes. He's got a little Datsun 510 sedan. Those of us our age understand what that is. It's kind of a Japanese brick. It is this aerodynamic as a mailbox. But he has the same motor that we have in our car. He just has it juiced. And he also uses a different kind of controller than we use. It's a much more robust controller. But he's doing 11-second quarter miles, and he is setting track records everywhere he goes. And he leaves Ferraris and Corvettes and Roadrunners and Novas in the dust. And that's
you
the
know
kind
what? That's respectable.
What's that?
That is quite respectable. Gee whiz.
It is interesting to watch because he just has one speed. He just mashes the throttle and it burns a little bit of rubber and takes off. But the electric motor has a torque band that's about 10,000 RPM. And a gas motor has a torque band that's about 2,500 RPM if you have a really good cam.
Right.
So
I got to tell you something. Let me tell you. Do you know what I've been up to for the past couple months? Well, I'll read it to you in
Hong Kong. I know part of it. I know part of it.
Well, I got to tell you, I ran into you in Holland, and I'm so glad that I did, because I've heard of your name for many, many months and years. And the reason I pursued this is because I need to go to the next step in racing and high performance. And it is with Zero Point and with the Breakthrough Energy Movement. And the boys in Holland asked me to come over and be a host at the seminars, and that's how you and I met, correct?
Yep, that's right. Yes.
And I have to tell you, I think in some way that by what you and I learned over there and have brought back with us, that we are going to be able to continue the legacy of racing and what has been the passion of our weekend warriors here in our country. And that makes me happy.
Yeah, I mean,
that's that I can give back to.
We have a society in our country called the Society of Automotive Engineers, SAE, for those of you who are familiar with the acronym. And there are a lot of young bucks that have entered that arena. And as you know, the automotive industry has suffered a terrible bout of unemployment in those ranks. So there's a lot of talent out there that's underemployed. In short, it needs a place to go. And it's gravitating to this new energy movement, this breakthrough energy movement. And Stephanie is one of the organizing forces between SAE and the breakthrough energy movement. So I think we're going to see marvelous things.
Go ahead.
I think we're going to see marvelous things here.
I have to tell you, the SAE group here in the United States is, I'm breathless. They are the most organized, the most forward-thinking, brilliant minds, young brilliant minds that I've ever met with in my entire life. I met with the ASU, which is the Arizona University here, and I got to tell you something. It was so unique just to look out. This was 2 years ago. To look out and see these brilliant minds saying, I want to go racing. I want to learn more. What is the technique? Where do I go? These are incredible little genius minds that we need to cultivate. And Brooks, they're in your doorstep. You need to take them and run with them.
Well, that's my plan. That's my plan. You know, when we took on one of the NASCAR frame shops, they make advanced suspensions. They make motors between 500 and 2,000 horsepower at this shop. And when I brought the electric vehicle project to them, because I needed a shop to build this advanced drive that I just patented, I mean, I could have built it, but I don't really have the skill in welding the aluminum and selecting the right materials and getting the geometry right, and this crew did. The four guys that worked on this drive with me, I drew the blueprints, but they actually did the metal work. They looked forward to coming to work every day. They told me that they, all the years that they built race cars, not Formula One, but championship cars, Formula 5000 cars, circle cars, and NASCAR cars, that they got bored. It was just old hat to them. They liked this new technology. You know, our rear suspension only weighed 33 pounds.
That's amazing. Amazing.
And it will carry 1,000 pounds. But, you know, of course, when I was in engineering school, I built a suspension bridge out of toothpicks that could hold 200 pounds.
Do you realize how many race teams would just kill to have that knowledge?
Well, yes, but you have lots of rules and regulations in race teams.
That's true. But you know what? I got to tell you something. I was around when they made the rules and regulations change. I was there when they changed the chassis, when they changed the engines. You know what? They will do anything they can in NASCAR to make it work to continue racing.
Well, I was talking with Leilani Munter. She's a former NASCAR driver. They call her the carbon-free girl. She was a talented race car driver, never, you know, a first place winner or very rarely first place winner if she managed to be in the right place at the right time. But for a woman to make it in NASCAR is pretty tough. It's a pretty rough and tumble business, even for really, really good drivers. But what she liked, she pressured NASCAR from a green standpoint. And I think she was the one that finally got them to change from leaded gas to unleaded gas. And that was just
That's right. And if you'll remember, I worked with Swift Fuel, which is the biofuel that proved themselves in a NASCAR and in a Formula One plane and in an offshore powerboat. And, you know, good for her. We need more women like her. We really do. And it's possible.
Yeah, it is. I got pictures of her driving the truck, and she really, really enjoyed it. I wish we'd have got the funding last year. We would have been in production. We're still, like alternative energy everywhere on the planet, we're all struggling, you know, for the same thing. The competition in the financial market is oil and banking, and we just don't have an attractive enough value proposition for them. We just can't compete with oil. We have to come at it from a different standpoint. And racing is suffering from the same thing.
Rick, tonight, what do we want our listeners to hear? What's most important and in your heart?
Well, I have a dichotomy. On the one hand, I'm very excited, you know, to be an innovator. I've been on this edge of the wave my entire life, no matter what car company I worked for. Now I work for my own, and I'm still there. But I also have a level of frustration and a cynicism that has been growing the last 2 or 3 years because I've become so disheartened and so frustrated with the financial community in this country. It's just sickening to watch the gluttony and the corruption in Washington and to watch thousands and thousands and thousands of small businesses struggle and die every day because their own government is competing against them for borrowed money.
So, Brooks, let's put it this way. Let's ask our listeners to really pull from their heart, pull from their gut. If they have the adrenaline, the rush, and they really want this to succeed as a pastime, as a sport, give us a heads up. Let us know what they need. We will be there, and we can raise the money to help them and help us because we have the motors. We have the conduit.
They could write the sponsors. They could write Tide, and they can write sponsors that are already buying signposts on 200-mile-an-hour NASCAR cars and say, hey, we would like to see alternative energy racing.
No. Brooks, what I'm saying to you is you have – and I'm just saying this to your listeners, and I know this well as a fact. You've got the ability to put this idea on the track. Tell your listeners to contact you, donate to your cause, be there, be supportive into your cause, because I know that my teams, my drivers, and I will stay racing because of what you're doing, because of your innovative engines, because of your marketing, and because of your way of doing business, rather than looking for the money, looking for the opportunity. And you just look forward to making sure that people receive what you're able to give.
Well,
and that's unique.
Sure. Now I get the picture, and I understand why Stephanie Paulus is such a great organizer, because she has a way of cutting through the crap and getting to the root idea, which is, go right to the listener and say, hey, why don't you go to visionmotorcars.com, click on the donate button, and let's go build some trucks.
Do you know what? You're absolutely right. You know, I'm just so tired of the bullshit out there. I've been doing this almost 32 years since I was 17. And you know what? I'm ready to go racing in the right way. And that is the way Brooks Agnew develops, produces, and puts his vehicles out on the market. You know, I'm done. I've been to the 24 Hours of Le Mans. I've been to Monte Carlo. I've been to all the big races. I'm done. I just want to go racing for racing's sake. And I want to produce a motor car, a truck, that is correct for humanity. And Brooks, you know what? That's why I support you.
I really appreciate that. I'm humbled to the dust. My partners in India are paying $11 a gallon for gasoline. There are things that don't get delivered in India because people can't afford to buy the fuel. They'll pedal it. They'll carry it on their backs, but they can't afford to drive it. This truck is needed all over the world.
That's true. Brooks, I would highly recommend that anyone that's listening go to the Global Breakthrough Energy Movement and support you and support me and support humanity, because we're coming to the U.S. and we're going to blow the doors off everyone, including mainstream media, including the top three people in and companies in Detroit, and we're going to be here, and we're going to be in your face, and we're here for the public, we're here for humanity, and it's as simple as that.
I love that kind of talk. I used to talk that way when I was in high school, because I'll put it this way. I paid my fair share of speed tax in my life. But Stephanie, have you ever built a car that actually had the doors blow off?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know I have.
Yeah.
Tell
us about the car that doors blew off. Tell us that story. Who did you build the car for?
Tell you what, my most incredible mentor, God bless him, he passed on, is Carol Shelby. And he is the reason, the one reason that this girl stayed into racing. Because he said, all right, girlie, if you can withstand what I'm talking to you about and put me through, you can be a best person in PR positive in automotive. How's that? You know, I thought, oh, God, I was scared the bejeebers off me, and that was like 20 years ago. And lo and behold, at the end of the 90s, into the 2000s, he created the, and this was when he was going through his organ transplant, and he had turned his company over to another person, and he was trying to go through the Series 1. The Series 1 was a Chrysler product, and oh, my God, it was to go up against the Ferrari and all the big high-performance sports cars. And God bless him. It was what you and I know as a cell-built car, C-E-L-L. And cell-built means not, you know, like jail cell. It means that one mechanical engineer builds that car from top to bottom, from start to finish, and delivery. And what happened was, is there was a little upset. There was a little bit of a, maybe a, just a margin of maybe 1/8 of an inch or 1/16 of an inch differential between the door and the body. And when that happened, they brought me in to do a spin on it, public relations-wise, and I did. And I spent my time up in 2 weeks in Las Vegas and 2 weeks in Phoenix. And I got to tell you something, that was the best education of my entire life. He is phenomenal. That racing experience, high performance experience, gave me the compassion and passion, if you will, to be where I am today. I know what the American public and our mechanics and our blue collar and white collar people are able to produce. It is beyond belief. And we need to stay there. We need to keep it up. But we need to go into zero point. We need to go into alternative energy. And we need to take it to the next level. And you, my dear, that's how I met you, is in these conversations.
Well, a lot of things happen at these energy points that the average person doesn't know. And I can't go into a lot of detail because some of it I don't know, and other parts of the detail you just wouldn't believe. But suffice it to say that when you add some of these energy devices to a vehicle, space and time can actually shift on you. I don't really know how to explain it, but the first electric vehicle I ever drove in was in Japan in 2001. I was working for Toyota, and we had an electric van. It was a hybrid, but we tried to drive it where the gasoline motor didn't turn on. And it drove pretty well, but I could tell you there were six of us in this van as we were going back and forth between these different engineering locations. And now that I look back on it, the months that I spent there, every time we drove in that van, we got in an argument. Some kind of energy was in this van that was just irritating. Just didn't know what it was. Once we were outside the vehicle, everything was fine. Inside the vehicle, it was quiet enough. It was smooth enough. It was just like a normal, you know, Sienna Toyota van, but it was electric. And the darn thing would just leave you in a state of tizzy. And now I understand what it was. It was the oscillator of the inverter that was causing us to have this anxiety attack, almost all of us in the vehicle. And I learned from that. And then when I did my research in Santa Monica, when we were working with the Lifestream generator, I learned about these rotating DC magnetic fields and the euphoria that you feel. Well, in our experiments, we built two of them that were 4 million volts apiece. And we were going to deliver one, and the other one was going to stay there in the lab with us. And we were getting ready to load it on the truck, and John and I had this crazy idea. Hey, let's turn them both on.
Oh.
So we set them 5 feet apart, 60 inches on center. Lord knows why I even selected that distance. I don't know. I didn't measure anything other than just say, let's put them 5 feet apart. These are about 72 inches tall and about 16 inches around. So it looks like a white pillar. So we made kind of like a doorway out of it. And we turned them both on. So I got 8 million volts there. Now, you could touch them, and, you know, it makes the hair on your head rise up. Now, this is very low amperage, mind you. It's not going to electrocute you, but I wouldn't recommend going through it with wet feet. And I had a watch on that was it's not a Casio, but it starts with a C, and it's an expensive watch, electric watch. I walked through this gate several times, and then I stood in between it and just enjoyed the field. You could feel it kind of like a physical pillow that you're walking up against, and then you just kind of push yourself through it. My watch lost 2 minutes. And, yeah my watch lost 2 minutes while
that
I was doing this that day. But I felt marvelous. I mean, not just good. I felt marvelous. Now, this was in the spring of 2007, and I have not had a cold since 2007.
Huh. What do you attribute that to?
I attribute it to that field. That field was so powerful. It did something to my DNA. It did something to the cells in my body. And so when I started building electric vehicles the next year in 2008, I started with that idea that I was going to start with an oscillator at that frequency. I was going to stick with DC. I wasn't going to have an inverter in the vehicle. I was going to keep the field aligned in a certain way. And sure enough, if you drive for a couple of hours in this truck, you feel great. You feel great.
It's, you know, like, what? That does not surprise me in the least.
Well, this is the kind of stuff that you get exposed to with this zero point technology. It is really phenomenal.
Well, it most certainly is. And you know what? You're right. Let's revert back to what you were talking about, the SAEs, Society of Automotive and Aeronautic Engineers. And those are the young gentlemen and women that are in the universities, they're undergraduate and graduate degree people, unbelievable people that I think we need, you and I, Brooks, need to bring them into our programs.
I agree. I think they need to learn how to, I could sure use them this week. I'm trying to shrink the size of the circuit that takes the energy from the solar panel and puts it into the batteries. I have it small enough now it can fit into a really tiny box, but I think I can get it smaller.
Yeah.
I need these guys. I need people that can weld. I need people that can solder. I need people that can build stuff from schematics or even draw schematics. I could use them right now.
You know what, Brooks? I need people that can complete a sentence. Does that make sense?
And be able to keep their pants they're supposed to be.
You know what? I really do. And they get it and know that, you know what, this is our future. And we've been given a gift. Let's take it and run with it.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. You gotta have fun at what you do. And you got to realize that not only, and don't listen to the news media that's trying to tell you that electric cars are stupid, that people will never accept them, that the public doesn't want them, and that's why they're not selling, and blah, blah, blah. That nothing could be further from the truth. People tear my doors down to get at these vehicles. The hardest thing about taking them to a trade show is getting the darn thing back on the trailer. Nobody wants to let it go. It's that popular. That isn't it at all. It's totally other forces that are keeping these vehicles off the road. People are excited about this technology. They want it.
I'm going to send this out to you and to your audience. I'm in Arizona. If there are any Society of Aeronautical or Aviation or Automotive Engineers out there that would like to participate in the programs I'm involved with, which is Breakthrough Energy Movements, please contact me, and that's through Brooks's website. And I mean that, Brooks. I would be more than happy to work with your audience.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. Any people that want to network that way, networking doesn't cost anything. Okay?
No,
so,
it doesn't.
You can do that. By the way, our SAE code, our World Manufacturing Index number, is 53C. So I am a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers International.
So, Brooks, let me ask you something for all of us inquisitive minds out there. What's next on your agenda? What are you up to this week, next week, and the next month?
Well, that's top secret. No,
well, the question is a top secret. Let's hear about
what we're doing right now. Is we are gearing up for mass production of this little truck. Now it's a 96 inch wheelbase truck that can carry 1,000 pounds. So it carries twice what a Ford Ranger does. It has a larger bed but a smaller footprint, and as you know, in the automotive business, when you get to this point, you're past the R&D point, you're ready to go into production. This is when the barbed wire fences go up. This is when nobody from the outside gets inside. So we don't talk about too much what goes on inside the building, because this is game changing. This is where the rubber meets the road, what we like to say in the industry. So what's up for us is we're talking to several different commercial users of small trucks, big fleet owners, and some leasing companies, and we're trying to get some features into the truck that are quite innovative. In fact, they're so innovative that once people see them and drive them, it's going to change regular gas-powered cars as well. It doesn't bother us if it does, but we definitely have some novel things that are going into an electric automobile that that you haven't seen before.
Okay, that's what I need to know. Okay, so if someone would come to you and say, okay, Brooks, I just bought a Tesla car, but yet I want to buy one of your trucks. Tell me the difference between the two.
Well, for one thing, you can buy four of our trucks for what you can buy one Tesla for.
Oh, my God.
Our trucks retail for $28,500. And
okay.
If you're a commercial driver, well, even if you're not a commercial driver, there are...
Let's say I drive every day for my own private company.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, we have put together and patented an SPV, which is a special purpose vehicle. It's a finance term.
Oh,
it
okay.
It means you can buy the vehicle for $28,500, but because we've put certain features into the vehicle, which are the only ones in the world, only vehicle in the world with these features, you're eligible to write off almost the entire vehicle. In other words, if you buy a $28,000 truck, you'll end up spending about $2,000 or $3,000 out of pocket. And then you don't have to buy fuel for the next 10 years.
That's phenomenal.
It is phenomenal.
Okay. But my demographics, and I live in Scottsdale, Arizona, and they say, okay, Stephanie, tell me the difference between the Tesla chassis battery pack and your favorite from Brooks Agnew. What's the difference?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked that question. The Tesla battery pack, 1,168 small batteries that are a little bit bigger than a AA battery. It has 1,168 of those beggars. And the biggest challenge about charging and managing that many batteries is keeping the voltage exactly, and I mean within 1/100th of a volt of each other. And so it takes a very elaborate and expensive and sensitive battery management system. Now, the other issue is called thermal runaway. You've noticed this when you charge your iPhone 4. The little beggar gets hot. Well, so does the Tesla battery, and it takes lots of water with ethylene glycol in it to keep it from freezing in the winter and boiling in the summer. It takes a water pump to circulate it, hoses to carry it, a radiator to cool it, and a fan to pull air across that radiator. All that adds weight, all that adds complexity, and it adds cost. Our battery is air-cooled. It is much more advanced than the Tesla battery, which is now 5-year-old technology. It can be serviced in a matter of minutes. You could drill a hole in the side of it with a 3/8 drill, and it was non-toxic. And it is a fraction the cost. The Tesla battery costs $48,000, and our battery runs around $11,000 right now, and the cost is going down.
You know, that is just, that's amazing. And, you know, if people ask me, when they interview me and when I talk to people and I stop in shopping malls and I just went over to Scottsdale Fashion Square and quizzed the guy at the Tesla storefront. That's amazing. And they have no answer for me. And you just answered my question. Thank you.
Now, the other issue with lithium metal batteries, and there's various metals. Some of them are lithium manganate batteries like the Nissan battery. Some of them are lithium ion or lithium polymer batteries, which are highly unstable. And then there's lithium iron phosphate, which is the leading technology right now. And in the near future, we have lithium titanate coming out, but lithium titanate is prohibitively expensive right now. The issue is toxicity. The issue is long-term stability and cost. So,
okay, so Bruce, I've got property in New Mexico that I'm looking at, and I need a vehicle, like a pickup truck or a transport truck, and I'm looking at $50,000. And you're saying that your vehicle coming in at about $30,000 will do the same job.
It will do the same job, but it won't go as far. A gasoline-powered vehicle will go and won't go as long as you put fuel in it.
I don't need it to go far. I need it to be durable.
Oh, it's durable. You have a lifetime warranty on the drivetrain. You will not wear it out, no matter how long you live. The drivetrain will last for 50 years.
Okay. All right. Well,
the
you know what,
bat-
that's, that's-
because we have employed special technology to elongate the lifespan of the battery, I'm sorry to say we don't know how long the battery will last. It's designed to last 7 or 8 years. With the technology that we've added to the battery, it may double that.
Okay. Well, Brooks, you know what? I'm working with the Breakthrough Energy Movement from Holland, and we're looking at bringing an event to Boulder, Colorado in October. Can we see one of your trucks or your vehicles there? I would love to have it there showcased.
Well, that's my plan. I have missed a few shows this year already because I've had to earn money instead of taking time off and go wash the truck. But my plan is to be out there in Boulder with the Everest, at least one of them, maybe two of them, and maybe
if
we can get it out of the R&D shop, maybe one of the cars.
Well, I tell you what, it just this particular event is going to be unbelievable because it's not like any trade show event or consortium or anything else that's happened here in the U.S. It's going to be knowledge that's given to the public about not only your product, but the energy that is free to the universe and to everybody that is on this planet. So, you know what? I just thank you for everything you've done. You are amazing to me, and you're amazing to the Breakthrough Energy.
Well, I appreciate that. You're amazing to me because while I was in the stands, you were making what happens on the track happen, and that you have my immense respect because look at the egos that you have to manage that business.
Well, you know what? It was all learning experience. They all thought I was bugged up, but you know what? I'm going to be racing, and you're going to be racing long beyond them. And they're going to be looking to us saying, you know, can we come sit in your stands or be in your pits? And we're going to say, you know what? Maybe yes, and maybe no. Well, it's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. You know, I have been very blessed, and the universe has taken me into every corner of the world to learn how to do this. But in a roundabout way, I've met you. I've met the folks at Breaking the Energy Movement. I've met many people that are going to take us into the next era of existence as far as energy. And believe me, folks out there, if you're listening to Brooks, tune in every single time you can because it is absolutely imperative that you listen to what he's teaching you, knowledge that he's given you, and what you can learn from him, because I do.
Well, appreciate that very, very much.
Well, there you go.
Napa's NASCAR driver came over to the shop the other day, and he was looking at the truck. Of course, we painted it NASCAR, our Napa yellow, because Napa's one of the companies that's test driving. And Martin Truex is a nice guy. He's one of the nice guys in racing, to be sure. Very quiet, very mild mannered, and a heck of a driver. And so we just appreciate the racing community so much, and we support them. And hopefully, you're going to see VMC Everests and Ravens out there pacing races in the very near future.
Well, I have no doubt.
It takes no doubts.
I have no doubts. You know, you just got to be, you have to just move forward. And you know what, Brooks, here's my thought to everyone in your listening audience. Do you know what the favorite saying is that was given to me when I was a very young girl is no, the word no, N-O, has a 24-hour shelf life. Do you know what that means?
No.
That means if someone tells you no, whether it is a loved one, a beau, a corporation, an educational or a university type person, it means that no is a 24-hour window. It means that the next day if you reword your sentence and go to someone else, you're going to get a yes. No has a 24-hour shelf life.
Just don't take that for gospel. You know, not that no means no, but no means you're going to have to make your case a little better. And
That's right.
The reason I taught that to my kids, because my parents used to say no, and I'd say why, and they'd say, because I said so. I never said that to my kids.
Yeah, I know, me too.
So, you're right. It had a 24-hour shelf life, or maybe less, because they come back. Well, what about if I do this? Well, you know, since you put it that way. Okay.
There are always doors. You're absolutely right.
And I think if you teach your kids that, you teach them that nothing can stand in their way if they're determined.
Well, you know what? Nothing can stand in the way if it is with integrity, if it was right, and if it is for the betterment of mankind. And that's exactly how it works out.
Well, and
that stuff gets delayed
because of the egos of the people that are in business at the time.
But here's the catch, Brooks.
Okay.
When it does come back to you, and it does happen, and it works out, you're not off the hook yet. You have to go out, and you have to say in gratitude, thank you for giving me this, whatever it is, and I appreciate whatever it is, and I return with integrity what you have given me.
You know, that's really missing in our society, that gratitude, and maybe we should approach the challenge with the attitude of gratitude. Maybe that's why the two words are so close to one another. Somebody asked me once, what is the secret to success? And they said, is it good looks? Well, I can tell you right now, it's not. Or I would have been successful a long, long time ago. is it intelligence? No, it's not. I know very smart people that are broke as a church mouse. They teach at the university. It's not strength either. It is determination. And it doesn't matter whether you're missing a limb, your eyes, half your brain. You need to have determination. That's the difference between success and failure. There isn't a single successful person out there that did it their first try. And if you've read the book, Remembering the Future, you'll know it takes at least 8 tries to get the resonance going in your favor.
That's right. You know, there isn't a driver that I've worked with that hasn't gone back and said, Stephanie, I really respect the fact that you beat me up on gratitude. And don't you dare tell my wife, my girlfriend, or my team.
Yeah, that's exactly.
I've had drivers come back and tell me that. And it's true, because they're out there and they're trying to get past that last lap. They're trying to stream past that last person, that last car, and they're saying, you know, just get me past this last leg. And you know what? Sometimes it happens. Sometimes, you know, the universe says, okay, it's your time.
Well,
you know what? That's what we're looking for, Brooks. We're looking for our time. We're looking for the breakthrough energy movement consortium that gets us to the next level, that gets us to the point where we can give energy free back to humanity.
Well, it's out there. It is definitely out there. That energy, you know, I ask engineers sometimes, and I said this at the conference over in Holland too, tell me what electricity is. And they say, yeah. Well, you know, it's what comes out of the wall. You know, you plug in, you turn a switch. No. That is electricity. But tell me what it is. I mean, where does it come from? How can we create all this new electricity and shove it onto a copper wire in Yuma, Arizona, and turn on a light in San Francisco with it? What is electricity? And, you know, they can't tell me. And 150 years ago, no one had ever even heard of it before. So when it comes to new energy, when it comes to alternative energy or zero point that we've discussed here for the last hour and a half, it's just a form of energy that we're not familiar with yet. It's just on the other side of some ethereal divider, some membrane in space. Once we learn how to tap into it, and believe me, we're doing it, and we can convert it into electricity, we can use it to do stuff. We can use it to do work. It will be as common as the electric light in 25 years. But for now, on a technological scale, we're still on horseback. We're still on horseback compared to what we can do with new energy.
Right. No, I agree. So, Brooks, the next 12 months of your life and my life, I have dedicated, I don't know about you, but I have dedicated to my life to bringing in knowledge from all over the universe and out of the universe, if you will, to make sure that humanity knows what is theirs, and that is free energy. And with that, I'll say good night and farewell to all of your listeners. I look forward to seeing all of you in the future.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. Thanks for coming on the program. We'll talk again.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay, good night. All right, Earth Explorers, you know, it's so much fun to talk racing and to talk the competition that makes racing. I was listening to one of the race drivers in an interview one day. It was doing very well in the point standing. NASCAR is all about a bunch of stacked races, one behind the other. And when you place first through 12th, you get a certain number of points. Obviously, with first, you get the most points. With 12th, you get the least amount of points. But if you're in the top 12 a lot, then you get up in the point standings. And second place is pretty darn respectable. And this individual driver was number one in the point standing, but had not won a race that year. Number one in the point standing, but had not won a race that year. Had pulled a lot of second places. And the question was, you know, Mr. Stewart, you've won no races this year, but you've had a lot of second places, but you're number one in the point standing. How do you feel about that? And he said, nobody gives a damn about second place. And that's what he meant. Every time these great competitors go out on that asphalt track or that dirt track, they only think about one thing, and that's keeping the car together long enough to cross that finish line and making themselves perform well enough so that they do it first. And by perform well enough, I mean not only driving fast and staying out of trouble, but pitting at exactly the right time and taking the right kind of strategy with your team. That's the pit team and your management team to get there in first place. That's what wins races. That's what sells cars. That's what sells the products that are printed on the car. That's the kind of competition. So, you know, when I say that I like to hang out with winners or that I appreciate the spirit of a winner, that's what I mean. I don't have anything against the losers. Lord knows I've been in that place a lot of times, racing motorcycles, carts, or cars. But there's no feeling that's better than coming across the finish line first. Whether you're first in your class on a test or first in your class nationally or first in, you know, your SAT testing or your any kind of professional testing that you would do, placing the best in the country, there's a feeling that goes with that. There's a level of excellence that goes with that. That's what I'm talking about. That's the stroke of genius. Now, tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be on the Kevin Smith Show, so I want you to tune into that. We're going to be covering DNA as the newest data storage device. It's true. Researchers have stored Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and Shakespeare's sonnets onto DNA and successfully recovered it without a mistake. Now, the question is, and believe me, no one knows the answer yet, if DNA is actually a storage device, it can be encoded with the zeros and ones that make up digital technology. What is the message that's stored on human DNA? What language is it in? And what message is it trying to leave for us? Who encoded our ancient DNA, knowing that in these latter days, we would be able to tap into that DNA, wire it up, and receive and read that message? You want to know the answer? Well, you can tune in tomorrow night on the Kevin Smith Show and find out. KevinSmithShow.com. A couple of things I forgot to mention in the first because we got started really fast. Don't forget about the Food Investor. Dan and Scott out in Utah have created the most delicious, preservative-free food storage system. Not only is the food delicious, but it'll last for 30 years. So you buy it, put it in a backpack or a box at that hall closet where it's ready to go, and you will not have to be a burden upon FEMA if things go south, which it looks like they just might. But if they don't, no worries. You got the food in the closet. If they do, no worries. You can take care of yourself. Earth Explorers, it has been a pleasure being with you tonight here on X Squared Radio. Thanks for sticking with us through the technological problems. As I said, I have a GMO package here. If you're interested in having a copy of it, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I'll be happy to send it to you. Thank you for purchasing all the copies of Remembering the Future this week. I guess some interview must have played out there, but the book is selling well. I got a few more copies here autographed with your name on it. All you have to do is go to rememberingthefuturebook.com. Not only will you get the book autographed, but you'll get the audio version for free. So if you're not a good reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. And the last book, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, is also available at alienatednation.com or Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever fine books are sold. That is a call to action to get your governor to stand behind the Sovereignty Act that they have already signed. It's a chance to recover the Republic. Thanks again to Stephanie Paulus for joining us tonight on X Squared Radio. We made it through all the technical problems. We always do on race day. We always show up for the show. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.
Dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home.